You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show with Dr. Michael Roizen. This and other great health talk shows at RadioMD.com. Here are Joe Galewski and Dr. Michael Roizen, MD.
And you're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. Stay well on Radio MD. We're a passionate show. If you heard the first hour, you heard a great interview. You can always, if you miss any hour of our show, you can always look it up on the archives at RadioMD.com. You can go to iHeartRadio and sign up for us and get a podcast or anything else you want of our show. Great half hour. We talked about wellness foreplay. Artificial sweeteners change your gut bacteria so you develop insulin resistance or diabetes. That was our top story. The second top story was that 2 billion have the mineral deficiency of zinc, which reduces their ability to fight the common cold. The third was a story about Joan Rivers. We didn't get to how to choose your doctor. So that was the real age tip of the first hour. We're going to start with that now because that relates to the Joan Rivers story. What should she have done differently in choosing her doc? So the real age tip of the week, give me the sound of it, Sonar. Oh, we tricked Sonar into doing this. Anyway, the real age tip of the week comes from a question. I went to see a new doctor because to get my thyroid checked because I have been gaining so much weight. He was really fat, and I swear I smelled cigarettes. I felt like I couldn't trust him. Am I being too picky? Asks Vicky L. of Albany, New York. Well, Vicky, now we docs know from experience in our wives that doctors are humans. But overweight docs are far less likely to provide good weight management advice to overweight patients. And that's a matter of life and death. That's the same matter of life and death that Joan Rivers had, but she chose her docs but didn't have a proxy waiting for her. So with Joan Rivers, have someone, when you undergo surgery, who can answer the questions about can they do an extra procedure, and then have that person versed in the questions asked. Has this place done that procedure a lot? Do they have an emergency protocol in place with that procedure? Do they have the requisite people like anesthesiologists or emergency room physicians there in case? Do some investigative work for your own primary care doc and ask to see if the doctor sees other patients your age and with your health concerns, where he did his residency, and see if he's board certified for at least 3 years. You don't want a virgin. Lastly, treat the first appointment like a first date. If they don't ask about alcohol, tobacco, physical activity, food, stress, consider that a mark or two against. If you don't feel comfortable or confident with that physician, keep looking. Remember, you're paying the bill. And that's the real age tip of the week relating to Joan Rivers and you choosing a doc. Bridget, talk to me about the U.S. waistlines keeping growing.
Okay, so this was an interesting report that just came out this past week, and they looked at not BMI, which is typically looked at on the obesity maps of America, but they looked at waist circumference and essentially the amount of fat that's around Americans' waistline. And they found that after adjusting for age, the mean waist circumference has increased to 38.7 inches in 2012 from 37.5 inches in 1999.
And so what this is, and so what this is that women have gained, I think it's 1.8 inches, more than even men have gained in waist circumference, whereas men have gained about 0.8 inches. And if you look at it, the size that we are now at, waistlines larger than 35 inches for women and more than 40 inches for men create abdominal obesity, which means it increases your risk of heart disease, stroke, impotence, and cancer, as well as diabetes, because the fat in your abdomen hanging off your belly, we call it omental fat, increases your risk of all of those things because it creates inflammatory conditions. So this is really important. And as you get older, you've got to say, I'm going to get a thin waistline. So we often associate thin waistlines with being young, but you should have it when you get old, too. Bridget, so is that right that that's the 1.5 inches gained for women and 0.8 for men? Why did women gain more?
I'm not really sure why the women gain more than the men, but it probably has something to do with the age that they were at and their dietary habits, their sedentary lifestyle, and typical things that are usually associated with a larger waistline.
So the other stories that have reflect on this obesity issue are that we, of course, reported the story that if you have sugar substitutes such as saccharin, you change the bacteria inside your gut. So that's the reason in some people with genetic abnormalities, they, and some people is 4 out of 7 in the experimental group, but it's about 50% of people in the larger study of 341 people have differences in their bacteria that cause insulin resistance, or what we call the forerunner of diabetes, and increase their blood sugar when they have even sugar substitutes. There's something that the sugar substitute causes, that is saccharin or equal or the equivalent varieties in, I guess they used pink, green, and blue containers. All of them change the bacteria in a large number of people and in the mice they studied, so that those people became essentially diabetic or insulin resistant. And they cured them with giving an antibiotic. Obviously, you get other problems from giving an antibiotic. But that's why diet soda drinkers are often overweight. The third study on obesity that occurred this week was that obesity drugs seem to be harder to sell. Used to be when Fen-Phen was around, it was the most popular drug until it was found that it caused this mitral valve problem. It's been off the market for a while, and now the obesity drugs seem very hard to sell. Two new ones got approved. Contrave, which is the drug by Orexigen, got approved, and it's using the 900-person U.S. sales force of Japanese pharmaceutical giant Takeda to market its product. So there's a story about how they say, the Takeda people say, there's no magic weight loss cure. This helps you get over humps, and it helps you maintain it, but you need diet and physical activity as well. Are you seeing patients, Bridget, do you see people who consult with nutritionists who are already on these drugs, or most of them trying to do it without drugs?
It depends. Some of them, a lot of the patients that I think that we're going to be seeing in functional medicine are people that are trying to do it without drugs.
And that comes over to another story, which we'll get to if we have time. We have a great segment coming up with Gary Ginsberg, who's got talking about pesticides and imported teas, the importance of asthma development from whether you get phthalates, whether the mom gets phthalates in her diet, Alabama vets who went to Fort McClelland may have a worry, and we're also going to talk to, at the half past, the greatest guest I probably will ever have, because he's one of my idols at least, Mark Penn, who will talk to us about scarring versus growth. That is, that people with tobacco use either scar, or meaning they get, or they get cancer, meaning they get heart attacks or cancer, but not both, and what it means for what you should do differently depending on your type. We'll be right back on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show on Radio MD. You can always email us, of course, at udocs, Y-O-U-D-O-C-S, at gmail.com. As I said on the first half, on the first earlier today, this is the anniversary of our 13th show. Next week starts our 14th season on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. Thanks for listening, and go stay well.
If you've missed a show, the full audio library is at RadioMD.com. And now back to you, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And this is my favorite part of the show. It may not be yours, but I learn more from Gary Ginsberg every week. Gary Ginsberg, whatstoxic.com website. He is an absolute pro. And when we got this question yesterday, and you can email us anytime, udocs@gmail.com, we got a question. This is someone who put in a new HVAC system in his office, and he noticed in the last 3 days, and when he talked to the person who cleans it, they said it's happened all the time since they put it in. There's a fine aluminum dust, he thinks, and aluminum little particles that are coming through the system, and he wonders if he's breathing it. Has there been any damage in the 3 months since he's put a new system in? And what should he do? Gary, no one's better to answer this.
Yeah, well, it sounds to me like the installers of his new HVAC system didn't do a good job of cleaning out the ducts and vacuuming up whatever mess filings they left behind. And so, of course, in an air duct system, it's just going to recirculate and put into your airflow whatever dust and dirt that they left behind. Aluminum is not that toxic unless you're in an occupational setting where you're exposed to it day in, day out at relatively high levels. So I don't, and especially if you could see the dust, it's probably relatively large particle size, probably not getting into the deep lungs, so I wouldn't worry too much about it if I was him, but I would want that company to come back and do a thorough cleanup places he can't reach and see because it's in the ductwork, but I'd want them to come back and clean up the mess they left behind.
Perfect. Okay, now let's talk about the subjects that you gathered, the pesticides and imported teas. My wife has all these teas. We must have 4,000 different varieties at home. You know, she collects two things that, thank God, aren't very expensive. It's not like jewelry collection. She collects cards. We have four filing cabinets, full-length filing cabinets. If you have a birthday on any date of the year, she will be able to find a card for you. If you have an anniversary, etc. And the other thing she collects are teas.
So you've got the Hallmark wife, but she's also a tea collector. Well, you know, tea is something we don't think about with a lot of pesticides, but they actually do use a lot of pesticides to grow tea, apparently, especially overseas in places that are very warm. You can get a lot of different kinds of bugs, mold growing in it. So our tea, they're not residues. There are acceptable tolerance levels put out by US EPA for how much of different pesticides can be in tea. And this story coming out of India talked about a phasing out of one pesticide, endosulfan. Now, endosulfan is a pesticide in tea that should not be there any longer. EPA tried to revoke all the tolerances of it in 2011, and because other countries, this was impacting the tea-growing world, they couldn't meet the phase-out because they were so dependent on using endosulfan to kill bugs, that EPA extended the tolerances for endosulfan in tea to 2016. Now, these tolerances are mostly set up to protect the public. So if you're above the tolerance, it may be risky, but the tolerance is acceptable. There's no evidence that teas coming into this country have too much endosulfan. Endosulfan is pretty toxic, but at low enough levels, we can handle a trace of it in our tea. But what EPA is trying to do is get these countries to use safer pesticides. This particular story out of India said that what they're switching to is a really nasty toxic organophosphate called monocrotophos. And monocrotophos has been banned since the early 1990s in this country. So what I have learned in doing research on tea is that there are, for example, Bigelow has a lot of domestically grown tea. There is a lot of tea that's either grown in this country or you can buy as certified organic. So if you want, so if you drink a lot of tea, this is for people who drink a lot of tea, all right? If you don't, if you have the occasional once a week cup of tea, or maybe drink a little bit more in the winter time in the cold months, it probably doesn't matter because the residue levels are so low. But if you want to support a better form of agriculture, and if you want, and if you drink a lot of tea, you want to make sure the levels are safe for you, I would look for domestically grown tea. There's a, there are places like South Carolina that grow a lot of tea. They're not using these toxic pesticides. And also, try to find organic or domestically grown teas. But if you drink tea once in a while, I wouldn't worry a whole lot about it.
So occasionally, don't worry about it. Otherwise, go domestic.
If you're a heavy tea drinker, yeah, and look for domestic. I know Bigelow has their own farm in South Carolina. You do a little bit of research, and you should be able to find some domestic or organic, and that would get rid of the pesticides. Until EPA really sorts this all out, because they right now are under the crosshairs, and FDA has to check for monocrotophos. They're starting to use more of that overseas. We don't want that in our tea, and FDA better be on alert looking for that. And the price and the toll it pays on the workers who are exposed and spraying this stuff in the field under primitive conditions in India, that's really, you know, if you want to have cruelty-free cosmetics, that's great, but let's also go for cruelty-free tea.
I like that. Now, what about asthma in kids and phthalate exposure in the mom? Is that a problem?
Yeah, you know, this is research out of Columbia University. They studied 300 inner-city moms out of New York City. And they looked for whether there's a link. There has been some data prior to now that suggests that kids in the environment they grow up in, if there's more phthalates in their environment, in their bodies, they tend to have higher allergenicity, higher rates of asthma. This looked at prenatal exposure, and if the mom had more phthalate, which could be coming from cosmetics, as I've talked about on this radio show before, or it could be coming from just floor tiles, shower curtains, the home environment, even cleaning products could have some phthalate, that the children in their study, the women with the most phthalate in their urine had kids that, as they were developing their respiratory systems, had like a 75% higher risk of becoming asthmatic. And this is in the inner city where kids already have two strikes against them because there's more pollution, and just higher and higher dust mite levels in the inner city. And so kids generally have higher, 2 to 3 times the suburban rate in the inner city for asthma. And on top of that, phthalates are making it worse, according to this new Columbia University data. So it suggests that anyone out there, when you're pregnant, you want to be aware of phthalates are in your environment. And number one source is probably cosmetics. Again, look for cosmetics that are free of quote-unquote fragrance on the label. Essential oils are fine if you want to smell good, but try to avoid in your deodorant and in your cosmetics and in your body lotion anything that says fragrance, because that's likely a code word for a carrier of phthalate.
So the one exception that I know of, Gary, and I hope this is correct, is if it says essential oils only,
yes,
then it can have a fragrance but not have a phthalate with it.
Yeah. The essential oils carry their own natural fragrance, but it wouldn't say perfume. P-A-R-F-U-M-E, perfume on a label is the same thing as fragrance, and that will often be this cocktail of synthetic fragrance that some people are allergic to, but often typically has phthalate as a carrier, and that is what you want to avoid. If it says perfume, or if it just says the word fragrance on the label, if it says essential oil, you're much better off.
Gotcha. Now, why are the Alabama veterans at risk? I cannot. We've only got 15 seconds, so Gary, we're going to carry that over to next week. This is You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. Great segment with Gary Ginsberg. We'll be back next. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
Don't miss a minute. Listen at your leisure, always online and on demand at RadioMD.com. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And this is Dr. Mike Roizen. You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show on RadioMD.com. You can always ask us questions on toll-free 877-711-5211 or email them to us at udocs, Y-O-U-D-O-C-S, at gmail.com, Y-O-U-D-O-C-S, at gmail.com. I'm talking, and I have the privilege of talking now, to one of the people I think is done some of the most important work in medicine and is doing some of the most important work and is one of my idols. So if I stumble on words, etc., it's because I'm talking to one of my idols. He was at the Cleveland Clinic. He's left and is at Summa Healthcare, where he does his work clinically in Akron. And so I feel good that LeBron, even if he doesn't use the Cleveland Clinic, has someone outstanding in the backyard to take care of him. Mark Penn is the person we're talking to. And this started, this specific conversation that I wanted to have on radio because I thought it was really important to bring it to our listeners, started when Mark said, you know, if someone has a cigarette or smokes, they either get cancer or heart disease, but usually not both. And so I asked him, how do we develop that on a radio show to tell people what's different and why that's such an important concept? Mark, thank you for coming.
Oh, thanks, Mike, and thanks for the kind words. Real pleasure to be here.
So tell us what that means.
Yeah, so there's some interesting literature when people have looked at patients who have COPD or emphysema, usually from a long smoking history. And what they've noticed is if they have emphysema, they tend to have a lower rate of developing, actually if they have heart disease, they have a lower rate of developing lung cancer. And so the idea being that we've been pushing forward is this idea that patients either scar their arteries in response to smoking and develop heart disease, or they try to heal their scarred arteries and then they develop lung cancer. And this whole concept that we've put forth has really come out of the very exciting work that many have done over the last decade and a half in the area of stem cell research.
So why is this important for anyone to know about? In other words, what difference does it make whether you scar with a scar or heal by, if you will, a growth? What difference does that make, and why should it matter? Does one do something different because of it?
Well, I think in a bigger picture, when we think about how to live the longest life we can, what these data may suggest is that heart disease and cancer aren't two different diseases, but in fact, they're two different responses to injury. And if that's the case, then the key to living a long life and a productive one is actually minimizing our injuries. And it's not about preventing cancer or preventing heart disease. It's really minimizing the injuries to our body, which therefore will minimize our need to either scar or to heal that injury. And so, you know, lots of things that everybody talks about, sunscreen, not smoking, diet, exercise. If we can minimize those injuries, we minimize the body's response, need to have to respond to that injury, and therefore may lead to a prolonged life.
So what this really means is that we should do all those things that help prevent injury in the first place.
That's right.
rather than looking at, in other words, when I think of cruciferous vegetables, I think of, well, cruciferous vegetables may have something special in them that helps prevent cancer. But rather than thinking about that, we should say, what are the things that cause injury in the first place? For example, the phthalates or the pesticides that we just talked about in imported teas. Those things that cause injury in the first place should be minimized rather than thinking about what helps us recover from injury.
That's exactly right. Because if you have to recover, then depending on how you may be predisposed to respond to injury, you're going to either enhance further scarring or perhaps leave or partially healed tissue that may ultimately be tumorigenic or support tumor growth.
Now, that, by the way, we have a question from a Otis on the email line, and he says, does this mean we should change diets of kids and us at a young age? When does this start, he writes? And secondly, he says, does that mean we should, for example, go on a plant-based diet from the beginning rather than think about changing diet after we get heart disease?
Well, and I think those are really important questions. And, you know, I think one of the challenges for the folks who promote plant-based diets, and I'm a huge fan of Dr. Osselstyn's and what he does and truly believe in the work as he does, the question ultimately becomes, though, should we go full plant-based, or could we, in fact, weave in a plant-based diet into our diet so that maybe 4 days, 5 days a week we do that, and that would then help minimize the number of injuries over our lifetime? It ultimately becomes an integral over time, and the question becomes how many times do we injure? And I think there's a lot of potential value in, you know, at least in this day and age of a Western diet, to minimize our injuries, at least on a part-time basis, because it's probably related to total number of injuries, not just any injuries. As far as starting as a child, I think, you know, instilling good habits in children early on is a good thing. We'll learn with the obesity epidemic in kids now whether they ultimately, even if they change, have done enough damage to cause early cancer or heart disease.
Well, that goes with his second question. So I guess the answer on the second question is, when do you need to start minimizing injury? And his question really is, when kids are teenagers or younger, do they have a different response to injury, or is this when cancer and heart disease are starting? Or do we get a break till age 30 or something?
Yeah, I don't know that we get any breaks, but I think there's an accumulative issue of injury over time. That is the ultimate goal to minimize. And what we do know, at least from the stem cell side, that in younger people, our adult stem cells are much more active and able to repair perhaps a little bit more vigorously. So it may be more beneficial with respect to the scarring side, but, you know, there's more and more literature out there and data showing that, you know, even young people who die of motor vehicle accidents early have evidence of atherosclerosis and scarring of their arteries. So it's really unclear that there's any free period that we get.
Now, this is strange because it's asked by a woman, and maybe it's not strange. Bonnie says, does this mean, and are you telling me that some of the tumors, the brain tumors that seem to be coming up in these football players, may be the response to brain injury, whereas the other people who develop dementia may get scarring? Is that a difference from the same problem? And tell you what, since we're right up against a hard break that the advertisers will be annoyed if I run into, I'm going to have that come back as soon as we come back, Mark. So keep sending your questions in. They're wonderful questions. They're stimulating questions for me as well as our guest, Mark Penn, who is, head of one of the interventional cardiologists or translational cardiology at Summa Health System, and a brilliant thinker as well as doer in this area. We'll be right back on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. You get a chance to send us questions, udocs, youdocs at gmail.com. Stay well.
If you've missed a show, the full audio library is at RadioMD.com. And now back to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And this is Dr. Mike. We have a set of questions for an outstanding guest. The outstanding guest is Mark Penn, who is head of cardiology at Summa Health in Akron. So we know that LeBron is safe if he can't make it to the Cleveland Clinic. And the other, the question that we had, and Mark was talking to us about the difference in repair by scars versus repair by healing, which leads to tumors. We have a series of questions, but one of them was striking to me, and so we may not get to all of the questions, but the one that was striking was, this person said, is the difference of why athletes are getting brain tumors and some athletes are getting dementia the difference between healing injury with scars or healing injury with cancer growth?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. That's a really insightful question. And exactly to the point of what we believe is going on. You know, this work started with the idea that we as mammals have really evolved to scar instead of heal in an attempt to minimize tumor. And it was really based on a hypothesis we put forth in 2000 that stem cell-based repair is a very natural process, but it doesn't work really well for us because we've evolved to downregulate the system. And what we've learned is how to turn that system on in a really meaningful way, and we've created drugs around it to study and hopefully treat heart failure, and we're doing these clinical trials at Summa Health System as well as other places through a company called Juventus Therapeutics. But, you know, one of the molecules we found that's so critical is stromal cell-derived factor 1, or SDF1. What's really interesting, and exactly to the point of the question, is brain tumors make a lot of SDF1. They create the environment for them to live, for that tumor to live and to grow. And one of the hypotheses, and exactly to Bonnie's question, is we think that people who scar and develop dementia really aren't able to turn that system on. And by not being able to turn that repair system on, they ultimately scar, and, you know, we know about scarring and amyloid deposits in dementia. Whereas people who can heal can actually help those tumors start. And all the things that we've learned that really make stem cells, adult stem cells, work really well are also things that tumors turn on. And so, you know, I think brain tumor is one of the more interesting ones because it really does create a microenvironment that really helps that tumor survive and live, and really is one of the reasons why glioblastoma is just such a difficult disease to treat. Whereas those people who develop dementia may not ever have a brain tumor, may not support the growth of that tumor, but they ultimately are scarring their injuries and having the consequences that we all know of for those loved ones who have dementia.
Now, this brings up a question that we had a guest on probably 5 months ago who had some very interesting data on after a stroke that you can essentially irradiate that area of the brain, but not with radiation, but with a red laser, which seemed to activate stem cell repair and regrowth of neurons in that area. So is that one of the things that is also happening? Can you use some form of energy to turn on these stem cell repair mechanisms?
Yes. So we have found this molecule, SDF1, to be turned on by red laser, turned on by scrubbing wounds. And we know when we scrub our wounds, they tend to heal. We've also developed a drug, which is a gene therapy, that turns it on in any organ we put it in. And that's kind of what's happening post-stroke in a program we've actually just recently started. What we're doing in heart failure, and we've treated a couple hundred patients now, and what we're doing is putting that drug in the heart to turn on the stem cell repair system. Because what we know is in these patients, the system's been downregulated. And again, we believe in mammals, it's been downregulated to scar instead of heal in an attempt to minimize tumor. But we're able to turn these systems on. We haven't shown any evidence of any tumor growth because we're only turning them on for about 3 weeks. But once we turn it on, we're basically telling the body this tissue's been injured and come repair it. And clinically, it's worked very nicely. We're through 3 phase 2 trials. It actually works in sternal wound healing. We can get healing with much less scar after open heart surgery. We've done it in diabetics with critical limb ischemia. So again, we as mammals exist and still have this system in us. It's just we don't use it very well. You can imagine that if you had early tumor in life, you won't ever grow old enough to have babies, and so we don't survive. Whereas we never evolved against heart disease and the scarring because that allowed us to live long enough to have our babies. So we think this is an evolutionary trigger. It's something we've evolved into. But what's particularly exciting is if we harness this either through red laser, drugs, even, you know, exercise when you have low blood flow to your legs will turn SDF1 on. This is a mechanism for us to try and heal ourselves. And now, depending on how we're genetically predisposed, it determines where we go in our life.
Well, David says, I have heart failure. Are the trials still open?
The trials are not open at this time. However, we will have a trial opening next summer. And David could get my info. I'm actually the director of cardiovascular research at SUMA. I don't want my chairman boss to be upset with me with the promotion you gave me. You can reach me at SUMA Health System, and I'd be happy to help David identify trials. There's a lot of other stem cell-based trials for heart failure out there, and always happy to help people find them.
And the next question is a very interesting one. Does that mean if I'm 50, I have a very bad family history, but normal LDL and other things, have not had a heart attack yet, but my doctor has been talking to me about prophylaxis because of my bad family history. I had a couple of brothers die in their 40s, and my father and mother both died in their 50s of heart disease, and talked to me about starting statins, DHA, and aspirin as prophylaxis. Does that mean I should probably do this since that's my genetics, heal with scars that kill me?
So as a cardiologist, I think, you know, folks like this gentleman who come to me and say, I'm the oldest living male in my family. I think we do need to be very aggressive with those patients with things like aspirin and cholesterol-lowering medicine. That said, also, not a good time to take up smoking. It's a good time to really watch your diet. It's very important to exercise, minimize stress, maximize, your overall sense of well-being to try and minimize all those things. Actually help activate and repair your body to minimize those things to try and prevent it. But also the medical therapy, contemporary therapy is also very important.
We've been talking with a great guest, Mark Penn, who's head of cardiovascular research at SUMA Health Systems. Spectacular session. Hope you can come back next week. We'll live again. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show on Radio MD. You can get us archived at any time at radiomd.com. Stay well.